Time now for WGN News. Here's Marty McNeely.
Thank you, Floyd Brown. Tonight is the last night 18-year-olds will be able to drink legally in Wisconsin. Last night, police arrested 764 drivers in an effort to crack down on young drunk drivers. Police are making it clear that they will be watching border hoppers from now on. 350 officials in four states were involved in the operation. 416 people were arrested on alcohol-related charges, and police say one out of every 10 drivers stopped was guilty of some offense. The Department of Housing warned homeowners today that people are making telephone calls saying they represent the department and soliciting information on home repairs and weatherizing. Commissioner Brenda Gaines said the callers are asking homeowners certain questions about their homes, then they ask if they need the services. Gaines said the department only makes such efforts after they're contacted first by the property owner. Anyone with information about the solicitations is asked to call the Office of Municipal Investigations. Congressman Paul Simon took his candidacy for Senator Charles Percy's seat in Washington to Hispanic groups today. Simon told workers for the Midwest Voter Registration Education Project he voted against the controversial immigration bill because it would make it easier for employers not to hire workers with Hispanic surnames. That bill narrowly passed the House and is now in the conference committee. The Illinois General Assembly is moving slowly toward adjournment today. Legislators are still trying to devise a funding plan for the 1992 World's Fair. The legislature also must find funds for statewide tourism and expansion of McCormick Place. A jury in New Orleans today awarded more than $10 million to a family as a result of the second-worst air disaster in U.S. history. Cheryl Hart reports that this is the largest settlement thus far.
A federal jury has awarded $10,090,000 to the family of a 9-year-old girl who was severely burned in the 1982 crash of a Pan American jetliner in a Kenner neighborhood. It's the largest award given in any of the lawsuits against Pan Am. 9-year-old Rachel Schultz received third-degree burns over most of her body when the plane crashed through her home. Her mother was also burned. Her older sister was killed. Earlier this week, an economist had testified that the family would need about $388 million to cover Rachel's medical expenses for the rest of her life. That $10 million invested now could help meet those expenses. Cheryl Hart, New Orleans.
A 500-foot cruise ship with nearly 800 people on board ran aground today off Vancouver Island in Canada. The Sundancer limped to port where it then settled to the bottom of the harbor where it docked. Four passengers were hospitalized. And the first week of play has been completed at Wimbledon. Jim Colasar wraps up the week's action.
At the end of the first week of Wimbledon, the top seeds are still alive. Number one seed John McEnroe overpowered Australia's Wally Masur in straight sets to advance to the fourth round. Number two and three seeds Yvonne Lendl and Jimmy Connors had already won their places in the fourth round on Friday. McEnroe has not had a tough match yet, but says he's disappointed in the level of his play. The number two and number three women's seeds advanced today. Chris Everett Lloyd overwhelmed Annabelle Croft, a 17-year-old from Britain. Hannah Mandlikova likewise had little trouble with Catherine Tandier of France. Odds-on favorite Martina Navratilova also won through to the fourth round on Friday. Jim Colasar, Wimbledon.
Cubs meet the Dodgers in Los Angeles again tonight. WGN airtime is 8:40. I'll check the weather forecast right after this.
When it comes to great-tasting food, Wags has a wonderful way.
Wags has a wonderful way.
You're right, sir.
Take Wags' super fluffy three-egg omelet. We make more than 10 different kinds.
Fluffy.
Delicious, too.
So fluffy, so delicious, almost every restaurant tries to make an omelet like Wags.
We did it, sir.
Oh, it's fluffy.
Yes, sir.
What did you do? Put a balloon in it?
Yes, sir. We put...
Try it again.
Oh, try it again.
You see, at Wags, we use only the freshest ingredients in our three-egg omelets, and Wags prepares them in a very special way. But that's our secret.
We found Wags' secret, sir.
Let's hear it.
Before the chickens give the eggs,
yes.
Wags gives them a real good shaking.
The eggs?
The chickens. Or maybe they don't.
Fluffy three-egg omelets or anything else on Wags' incredibly delicious menu is always made a very special way, 24 hours a day.
We did it, sir.
It looks and even tastes like a Wags omelet. How'd you do it?
It is a Wags omelet. We sent out and put them on our plate.
Get out.
You want the rest of this, sir?
Wags restaurants. The secret is our great cooking. No wonder folks love Wags.
Partly cloudy and cool, low about 53 overnight. Sunday becoming mostly sunny and cool, highs ranging from the mid or upper 60s near the lake to about 77 inland. Sunday night, fair and cool, low in the 50s. Readings at 6 o'clock this evening, O'Hara Midway reporting 69 degrees, lakefront 62. Humidity 58%, winds out of the northeast at 10, the barometric pressure falling at 30.02 inches. That's the latest news. Again, here's Floyd Brown.
Thank you, Marty. This has been WGN News and Weather. Portions recorded. Marty McNeely returns with more news in just 2 hours at 8:35 here on WGN Radio Chicago. Enjoy spectacular 4th of July fireworks both on the track and in the sky above Arlington Park this holiday Wednesday. See some of the nation's finest turf stars compete in $125,000 added grade 2 stars and stripes handicap. And you can cheer your favorite to victory in a special live satellite telecast at Arlington of the Suburban Handicap from Belmont. And after the races, enjoy a free, full evening of entertainment capped off with a dazzling fireworks show. Beautiful Arlington Park, first race 1:30, racing also this Thursday. Stock on Coca-Cola 12-packs at participating Amoco food shops and outlets. Just $2.99 with any gasoline purchase. Coke on sale at Amoco till July 8th. The Dr. Dan Kiley Show will be heard next week at its regular time of 6:30. Tonight, WGN suggests you stay tuned for this special presentation.
Radio in the 20s began as a strange noise, picked up an even stranger gadget. Crystal sets, manufactured rigs, homemade contraptions constructed of wires wound around oatmeal containers. The radio in those days had a big horn-shaped speaker. The very latest thing was a heterodyne, and later a super heterodyne. Nobody knew what it meant, but people stayed up all night listening to it anyway. In those days, distance reception was the thing. One citizen heard Pittsburgh, another Kansas City, and an occasional Magellan of the airways picked up Denver and even Los Angeles. In the 20s, radio scored a tremendous impact. On WGN, the Chicago Tribune station in the Drake Hotel, men and women thrilled to the Darryl Bryan fireworks of the Tennessee Evolution Trial. Sportsmen heard the roar of the motors as daredevils gunned their way around the Indianapolis Speedway, hitting 90 miles an hour. Harold Redgrange of Illinois ran wild against Michigan. 39-14, the score was. And an unknown announcer named Quinn Ryan delivered the play-by-play. And when the band played Hail to the Orange, in what Quinn described as the autumnal splendor of the scene, people felt as though they'd attended college. The 20s were the days of radio pioneering. Brash young fellows were doing things never dreamed of before. On WGN, plays, operas, ball games, and band concerts were broadcast. A couple of young song pluckers came on as Sam and Henry. Later, they were Amos and Andy. Little radio playlets were written, cast, and produced. On WGN, they began as dramatizations of comic strips. Mrs. Monahan's Boarding House, Gasoline Alley, Little Orphan Annie. In the 20s, WGN undertook to broadcast police calls as the boys in blue pursued bootleggers, burglars, and so on. The experiment cost $40,000 and kept the town in an uproar. One result was that listeners flocked to the scene of a crime before the police got there. Another was that the crooks became devoted radio listeners. It was the time that jazz came up the river from New Orleans. Only it didn't get on radio. It wasn't respectable. Dance bands remained pretty polite and pretty social. The great bands came a decade later. In the 20s, political conventions moved out into the open. Millions of Americans heard the national convention. In Chicago, from WGN, people heard their own familiar announcers describe the political scene. It was an age when Babe Ruth was the Bambino and the Cubs were pennant contenders. Prohibition, of course, was the big subject of the 20s. Prohibition and the flapper.
Hello out there in Radio Land. We invite you to reminisce for a while this evening as we explore the world of WGN Radio on the occasion of WGN's Diamond Anniversary. It was 60 years ago when the Chicago Tribune station first went on the air with the now familiar call letters WGN, which stands for World's Greatest Newspaper. And in the 60 years since then, those call letters have also stood for quality broadcasting and community service. My name is Chuck Shaden, and for this evening, I'm a member of the WGN family for a look back over the years at the station that has become the radio home of millions throughout Mid-America. We're in the Pierre André studio at 2501 Bradley Place in Chicago. This WGN Broadcasting Center was opened in 1961, and this studio is named for one of the premier staff announcers on this station. But let's go back to the very early days of WGN. Quinn Ryan was the first staff announcer, joining the station just a couple of months after it went on the air in June 1926. Ryan was a cub reporter for the Tribune, and he was also the editor of the newspaper's employee publication, and he moonlighted whenever possible as a freelance announcer. His bosses at the Tribune decided he should become a full-time announcer and was assigned to WGN in August of 1926. He did everything on the air. He read the Chicago Tribune funnies to young listeners. He did play-by-play coverage of football games, covered the World Series, interviewed celebrities, reported from the Kentucky Derby, and he was the announcer at the historic Scopes Evolution Trial, bringing his WGN microphone to Dayton, Tennessee, so listeners could hear the debate between William Jennings Bryan for the prosecution and Clarence Darrow for the defense. That unprecedented radio coverage, by the way, cost the Chicago Tribune more than $1,000 a day for WGN, a very tidy sum in those days. Quinn Ryan recalls the early days at this radio station.
That in the first 4 years of the existence of station WGN, when we had a staff of only four people, we had no commercials at all. I wonder how many people recall also that we used to have a silent night. We also had such a contempt for money in those days. We used to close our radio stations down at 7 o'clock, all of the Chicago stations. Did you mention that before, Jack?
No.
So that the listeners could get what they call DX. They could listen to Seattle and Louisville and Bangor, Maine, and so on. But our station took no commercial shows at all. It was a part of the public service of the Chicago Tribune that we should spend as much as $1,000 a day to broadcast the famous Scopes Evolution Trial, where I went down a week ahead and kind of lined things up, and provide such services as even the Democratic and Republican conventions of 1928, which we broadcast independent of the NBC or CBS networks in extent. There were only three announcers at both conventions, Graham McNamee representing NBC, J. Andrew White representing CBS, and myself representing little old WGN. And that whole expense was borne by the Chicago Tribune and its very courageous and imaginative publisher, Colonel Robert R. McCormick. In those days, our commercials were not selling something between phonograph records. We had such commercial shows coming from New York, and we chose to pick them if they pleased our program requirements, such as the A&P Gypsies and the Ever-Ready Hour and the Clico Club Eskimos. Sometimes they were the same orchestra, but they gave us only 3 minutes in every 30 minutes of commercial, and it was only institutional advertising.
Boy, those were the days. That was WGN's first announcer, Quinn Ryan, speaking of the early days of WGN during an on-the-air broadcast some 20 years ago. There were no formal rules of broadcasting for radio, you know, in the 1920s.
We broadcast both MPTunny fights, and we practiced. I don't think it's ever been done before. We spent our time trying to think of new ideas because we didn't have to make money, and we weren't making any money ourselves, so we just sat around and had a lot of fun and dreamed up things. A lot of the broadcasts that we might take credit for, and certainly I hope I don't sound like Khrushchev when I say that I was the first man to do the Kentucky Derby or the Indianapolis race and all of those things. We did them because they had to be done, just as Commander Hillary or whatever his name was, the great hero, climbed Mount Everest because it was there. We broadcast these things because somebody had to do it, and we decided to be the first to do it.
And WGN has been first over and over again all through the 60 years of its history, which we're celebrating this evening on WGN. That was Quinn Ryan. A contemporary of his was Henry Selinger, the director of the Drake Hotel Ensemble, which was heard frequently on WGN in those very early years. Selinger later became WGN's first musical director. He founded its music library and for a time was the station's program director. Speaking on the air in 1964, Henry Selinger remembered some early WGN performers.
It was in 1926, the latter part of 1926, that I was confronted with a crisis. Quinn had gone away to the radio war somewhere.
Washington,
I believe, and left strict orders with me to come up with a, what we call then a harmony team, but to bring one that was really professional. I had tried to hire the Luce brothers, Van and Skank, the Kaufman brothers, and offered as much as $2,000 a week. But in those days, radio was scorned by the strictly professional performer. So that prior to Quinn's return, I was left without an entry for this important assignment. In desperation, I called a man at the Chicago Theater and asked him if he couldn't scare up somebody who could qualify, two people who might have sung together long enough to actually sing in tune. They didn't know anybody, but suggested that I talk to their production manager. And they switched the phone to him. His name was Silvers, I believe, wasn't it, Quinn? Will Silvers?
Maurice
Silvers. And he said, yes, there are a couple of fellas sitting here right now who might consider it. And he gave me their names as Carell and Gosden. Well, I had heard them on WEDH, which was a competitive rival station. And they sounded as though they knew which way was west, and asked them to come over. What I didn't know at the time was that they were singing at WEDH for coffee and cakes. There was no money, but they assured me that they were worth a great deal more than they were being paid. And we discussed terms and finally arrived at a figure which seemed fair enough. And they were hired to work 7 hours a day, 6 days a week. 3 months after, I assured them, by the way, that they would have 6 months' employment. Shortly after they came, about 3 months after they came, I got a new superior by the name of McKenna, Ben McKenna, who, upon hearing these two, decided they were worthless and ordered me to discharge them. Well, my obligation was important to me, and I pleaded with him to see if we couldn't do something to keep them around long enough to fulfill their 6 months. The outcome was McKenna's genius, which conjured up this famous serial as Salmon Henry. 3 weeks after this went on the air, the two men were so disgusted with the assignment, they pleaded to be taken off. I begged them for the sake of my obligation to stay on. History is the rest.
Yes, the rest is history. That was Henry Salinger, musical director for WGN, recalling the start of Salmon Henry. Your dial is set at 720. This is WGN Radio in Chicago. I'm Chuck Shaden, celebrating the diamond anniversary of WGN, reminiscing with you about the past 60 years of programming on this station. We're in the modern, comfortable Pierre-André studio in WGN's excellent Northwest Side Broadcasting facility, but it's a far cry from the early broadcasting studios of WGN in the mid-1920s, 60 years ago, when the sounds of this station were broadcast to the Midwest from tiny studios atop the Drake Hotel on North Michigan Avenue in Chicago. And since WGN was located in the Drake, it was natural that the station would enlist the services of the popular Drake Ensemble, which played for guests at luncheon and dinner. Leon Lichtenfeld was a member of that ensemble, and along with Henry Salinger and others in the group, soon became members of the WGN musical staff. We spoke with Leon Lichtenfeld just the other day. He's retired and living in Las Vegas. He's 87 years old, in good health. He has almost total recall. In an earlier conversation we had, he remembered his days at WGN, beginning at the time when the Drake Ensemble was broadcasting daily over this station.
They would run a remote control wire
from the roof, huh?
From the studio, yeah. Up on top. Mm-hmm. But before, we had only one microphone in which Pierre-André, while he was announcing, had to run down 10 flights with the same microphone and hook it up downstairs. They couldn't afford two microphones. You have no, and those were carbon mics in those.
What did they have while he was running down the stairs?
Was nothing. It was just a blank, one-minute blank. They had an elevator waiting for him to grab him, run him downstairs. Now, you see, many people don't know this. This is the early days of radio.
Sure,
what we
is,
had to go
yeah.
through at those times, see? And until later on, we got better mics, and we had a wonderful engineer there by the name of Kyle Myers. see.
And he's the fellow that really put WGN on the radio.
He did everything for WGN. Nobody ever did the engineering work no place like Carl Myers did. Punchy, we called him Punchy. He did everything. And, of course, we had Quinn Rhine there, who later come on, see. Now, don't forget, WGN wasn't created until 1924, I believe it was, 1923.
Yes,
24,
yeah.
See?
And this is when now? When
this is I'm talking about the era of 21 and 22.
Okay.
Now, along came a fellow by the name of Erpstein, Charlie Erpstein. Mm-hmm. He bought the station, and he
from
named
the
two, it...
wealthy young men about town, right?
Yeah, that's right. And then he came along and bought the station. I forgot what his call letters were. He had something to do with Elgin. His transmitter was up in Elgin also, see? And he was something else. I could talk for hours on what he was, you know. He'd get on the air and never stop. And we got on, and don't forget, there were no commercials in those days. No advertising, nothing. And no script. There was no such thing as holding a script in your hand. It was Quinn Rhine that finally said we have to have a script, because later on we had an announcer make an announcement up there, and he closed. Instead of saying, this is WGN, he was reading the news, he signs off saying, this is WMAQ, the Chicago Daily News Station from the LaSalle Hotel. He was broadcasting the Tribune News. Sounds funny, doesn't it?
Well, why did he do that? Was he working for WMAQ at the
same
time?
No, his mind just left him. Oh, he didn't know he was. He just, you know, he became paralyzed. He didn't know what he was saying. He was
from that point on, Zapp to give him a script.
Yeah,
then, right?
And you know, after reading the news, he signs off, and I'll never forget the phone call comes in from the Tribune Tower. Who the heck was that? That was crazy. But
well, when did WGN, I mean, how did WGN acquire that station? They just outright, the Tribune bought it then,
The
right?
Tribune bought it. I think they acquired it in 1924, if I'm correct.
I believe that's when the Tribune started WGN.
Yes, and we called it Liberty, I believe, at that time. The Liberty Station had something to do
with
it.
Well, now, from my reading of some of these things, Leon, WGN had the Tribune owned the station called WLIB
out
of Elgin.
That's it, WLIB.
The Tribune had started its national magazine, Liberty.
Yes, that's how the magazine came. That was the call there, WLIB. When Charlie Erpstein sold the station to Colonel McCormick, to the Tribune, with one stipulation, that on Sunday morning we had to do a 15-minute broadcast from his home on State Parkway.
From Erpstein's home.
From Erpstein's home.
Uh-huh.
Now, we'd come in there on Sunday morning. Fred Mankin, who wrote
here
the Wabash...
Here, with the one microphone running in there?
One crazy mic. Fred Mankin, we carried a little organ, a portable organ, and Fred Mankin is the man that wrote the Wabash Blues.
Mm-hmm.
He played with me, and Leon Benditsky and myself, Leon Lichtenfeld and Bizarre, we had to go to Charlie Erpstein's home and do this Sunday morning broadcast. Now, we'd ring the bell, and Charlie would be told by the maid that the musicians are here. Now, the first thing that he offered us was a glass of whiskey and a glass of gin for a chaser. I'm speaking of a water glass, folks, and I don't drink at all. Sunday morning. This was right early in the morning before breakfast.
They had to charge the battery to get the station on
the air. He didn't charge me up because I didn't drink. If I take one drink, I'm under the table. But Fred Mankin, he had his fill, and then Charlie would get on the air, and he'd wander off and start talking about things. Only people that remember the days of Charlie Erpstein's broadcast can call in and tell you if they remember. Mm-hmm. These people have to be up.
Well, radio was pretty loose back
in
the early 20s.
It was as loose as a
like
goose.
That. But it was very, very interesting for the listener because they were getting something really brand new. For the performers, yourself and other people, it was a
great
new experience.
Nothing was prepared. Yeah. There was no format of any kind that you'd come up and say outside of the numbers that we would play, see? And this was it. Now, after Charlie passed on, the Tribune actually got hold of the station. Now, we had a couple of fellas that came up there. And that was Freeman Gosden and Charlie Correll.
Oh, yes.
And they came up, and they were known as hoofers. You know what a hoofer
they
is?
They were dancers.
A singer and a dancer come up and sing a song. One of the songs that Freeman Gosden and Charlie Correll put on was called The Kinky Kids Parade. Many people remember this song. They did it about 40 times a day until Colonel McCormick called in and says, if I ever hear that song again, everybody gets fired. That's all people would call in for with the Kinky Kids Parade. So we had to eliminate that one. Now these
And you were playing for them, right?
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. And they were doing a few songs at WEBH, the Edgewater Beach Hotel, you know. And then we corralled them, and they came over, and they worked for us. Now, in the early days of radio, there was a show called Andy Gump. I don't think you ever heard of it or knew it was ever on the air. We searched the Chicago area for weeks and weeks and weeks until we could get somebody who looked like Andy Gump with no chin. You know,
there was a comic strip.
Yes, it was a comic strip in the Tribune, but we had to get a guy that looked like him.
To be on the radio.
There was no television.
But why did he have to look like him?
I don't know. He wanted somebody like him. The colonel wanted what the colonel said. He wanted he had to have done. And I think it was Bernadine Flynn that came over with Mrs. Gump.
Oh, my gosh. And she later became Sade.
Yes, that's right.
Sade, right.
Now, we naturally, it didn't go too big. So the colonel got an idea that maybe we should have a colored script, you know, on. Well, the first ones we thought of was Correll and Gosden because they were end men in minstrel shows around this area. Mm-hmm. They play like Peoria, you know, Elgin, and all these little towns around here. I'll never forget that when we went on the air with Correll and Gosden as Sam and Henry, and they were such a terrific success that Balaban and Katz decided to take them to the different theaters, like the Chicago Theater, to the Tivoli Theater, Uptown, once a week, and to do a show. This was to get the people to come to the theater, because nobody wanted to go to the theater to miss, they didn't want to miss Sam and Henry. This is the truth. Now, I want to tell you that Sam and Henry, when they later became Amos and Andy, were the only ones. When they went on the air, the theaters in New York would roll out radios for the people to come to the theater. They'd stop the show and put Amos and Andy on. This is the actual truth. These were the only two that were on both networks at the same time. CBS and NBC later on at the same time. Another thing is that I will remind you that when the history of radio will ever be written, Correll and Gosden, Amos and Andy, will never be surpassed. Never.
Hello, hello.
Hello, this is Dr. Brown speaking.
Oh, hello, Doc. Yes, yes.
Your wife has just presented you with a bouncing baby boy.
Gosh, that's great, Doc. Oh, boy, I'll say I'm happy.
Oh, you have reason to be. And you can come over to the hospital right away.
What, right now?
Why, of course.
Oh, I can't come over there now, Doc.
No? Well, what's the matter?
Why, I'm just listening in on the radio to Amos and Andy.
Oh, Amos and Andy again. There's a very funny pair. Every night they're on the air and fans are gathered everywhere. A radio is handy. In homes or at a grocery store, people listen in and roar. They laugh until their sides are sore. And Amos and Andy, Amos and Andy, they're always in a stew. Bad luck seems to follow them no matter what they do. The boys are always trying, but they never save a bean. If Kingfish doesn't get it, then it's spent on Madam Queen. We laugh at all their troubles, but we hope they'll all end right. We wonder what Amos and Andy will do tomorrow night.
Order in the court. First case on the docket, Philip McCann, charged with felonious assault and attempt to kill.
Your Honor, my client is innocent. He has a perfect alibi. He was...
I object on the grounds of habeas corpus.
Outside you. Go on with the case.
Your Honor, the district attorney claims the prisoner was caught red-handed.
that he had a gun in one hand, a blackjack in one hand, and a knife in his other hand.
Hey, hold on there. How many hands has this fella got?
That's what I'd like to know. And I object on the grounds of Sanctum Aquarium.
That sounds fishy. What has the prisoner got to say for himself?
Your Honor, I was just...
Wait a minute, wait. The jury's asleep. Silence. Let the prisoner talk. Young man, where were you last night when this thing happened?
Why, I was listening in to Amos and Andy.
So was I. Prisoner discharged.
Amos and Andy, although they're never seen, they've become more famous than the team of Falk and Beam.
When you step on the gas or at a light you fail to stop, you hear that certain whistle and up jumps the traffic cop. His mind ain't on his business or the ticket that he writes. I wonder what Amos and Andy will do tomorrow night.
Oh, Bill, there goes your telephone.
No, that isn't a phone. That's my alarm clock.
Alarm clock? Say, who's getting up at this hour?
No one. I always set it so I don't miss Amos and Andy.
I wonder what Amos and Andy will do tomorrow night.
I wonder what Amos and Andy will do tomorrow night. That's really how famous Amos and Andy were, and they got started right here on WGN Radio Chicago as Sam and Henry. That Amos and Andy song, incidentally, was quite popular in the early 1930s. It was sung there by Arthur Fields and Fred Hall. And before that, we were chatting with Leon Lichtenfeld, an old-timer, member of the Drake Hotel Ensemble, who vividly recalled those early thrilling days of WGN. This is Chuck Shaden with a special program for the 60th anniversary of WGN Radio Chicago. Now, I have to tell you that while the Amos and Andy song was playing, I left the Pierre-André studio here at WGN's broadcast center here, and I walked way down towards the end of the hall and accidentally found a supposedly abandoned master control room. All kinds of old and out-of-date WGN technical equipment is stored here, and it's not been used for many, many years. It looks pretty good. Lots of dust. A little rust. Some knobs. A switch. Oh, there's some old program logs here. There's a turntable there with a bent arm. Oh, a bent arm. It's a big turntable. Oh, it must be for those old 16-inch transcription discs. You know, they used to record these some of the shows on big 16-inch transcription discs. And it looks pretty good there. I don't know about that bent arm. We'll see what happens. Maybe we'll find a disc for all I know. This is really an amazing console. You know, in the main control room of WGN today, it's a very compact control board with little slider panels on there and everything else. But these things, these are giant dials. These dials are as, I don't know, they must be 3-4 inches in diameter, and there's all numbers on them and everything. There's one dial here marked Studio 1, another marked Studio A. I wonder if they had a series of studios, A, B, and C, and studios 1, 2, and 3. There's a knob over here marked Mutual Net. That's from the time when WGN was affiliated for many years with the Mutual Broadcasting System. There's another dial marked Remote. Now, what's that over there? What is that? Oh, that's a dial marked Time Reverse. Time Reverse. And I wonder what that means. Here's another dial marked Year Select. Year Select. Here's one labeled Day and Date. Now, I wonder if I could... Wait a minute. I bet I can go back through time on this old control board. Now, if that's true, we might be able to hear some of the old WGN shows. And I picked up a microphone here in the studio. This is an old ring microphone. You know, it's a round microphone with a little box in there held on by springs at the four ends. And there's a little piece of tape on here, like masking tape. It's very frayed and old, and it says QR on it. I'll bet this is the microphone that Quinn Ryan, I wonder if he took this to Dayton, Tennessee for that Scopes monkey trial down there. That's a possibility. Well, let's see. We have all of this stuff here. Now, let's see what we can... Well, this is like going like Alice in Wonderland here. This is Chuck in Radioland. You know what I would like to do? Before I came in here, I was in the Pierre-André Memorial Studio. And on the door of the Memorial Studio,
there is a plaque that says, "This studio dedicated to one of broadcasting's finest performers, grandest gentleman, loved by all who had the good fortune to know him." I remember Pierre Andre because he was the announcer on Captain Midnight. And I would wait till the end of that Captain Midnight broadcast because he would give a secret message in code many times. And I would have a secret decoder, and I would decode that message. It usually said, "Drink Ovaltine," or something like that. But it was a great thing to have. And every year they would change the decoder because usually the bad guy would have the would get the decoder, last year's decoder, and we'd have to get next year's decoder to do it. It was a great time, and I'm going to set these dials here. Time reverse. I'll move this over. Boy, it's moving pretty good considering the age here. I don't know how old this must be. All right, year. Let's go back to 1940. Day and date. Well, after school, you just listen to Captain Midnight after school. September, went back to school. How about the last day of September? All right, September 30th of 1940. Now, let's see. If we can get this set, we probably can listen to Captain Midnight. Remember those airplanes and the gongs at the beginning of the show? Oh, boy. All right, let's set now. I'm going to turn this final switch and see if we can tune in to Captain Midnight.
The makers of Ovaltine present Captain Midnight. Captain Midnight, brought to you every day, Monday through Friday at this same time, by the makers of Ovaltine. Captain Midnight is a new program to many of our listeners. It is written for red-blooded young Americans, for boys and girls, yes, and for mother and dad, too, for everyone who's young in spirit. Captain Midnight will bring you plenty of excitement, mystery, suspense, thrills galore. It lets you live a story of real adventure, in the air and on the ground. You'll never want to miss a single broadcast of Captain Midnight, and you'll want all your friends to enjoy it, too. So be sure and tell them to listen in every day. And now, to Captain Midnight. We are about to embark upon a series of strange and exciting, dangerous adventures. Adventures that will lead us to all parts of the world. But now, in order that you may understand the amazing events which are about to take place, we take you across the Atlantic Ocean to wartime France. The First World War had reached a moment of crisis. The Allied armies were in danger of terrible destruction. And then, at the moment of greatest peril, the courage of one man helped save them from surrender and lead them to final victory. We take you now to a small bomb-proof dugout somewhere in France, where the flickering light of a candle plays across the strained face of a lone officer, a general of the Allied armies. He's studying a military map. Outside, the night is black and cold. Suddenly, we hear, but listen.
Come in. Major Steele.
Sir? Everything is prepared.
You have found the man?
I have.
What's his name? No. It's better that I don't know.
I agree with you, sir. There are only two people in the world who know the mission to which he has been assigned.
You and our leader at Washington?
Yes, sir.
Major, do you think he has a chance?
I am afraid the odds against him are about 100-1.
If he fails, it will be terrible for us all. It will... But enough of that. Bring him in.
Yes, sir.
Wait. I don't want to see his face. Blow out the candle.
Yes, sir.
Now, bring him in.
Yes, sir. Will you come in, Captain? The man is before you, sir.
You have your instructions?
Yes, sir.
Then I want to talk to you. To be sure that you understand the risks you are taking.
I do.
If you fail tonight, it will be the end for all of us. If you are successful, our country will be saved from defeat. Do you understand?
I do.
Also, if you succeed tonight, you will have started a long and dangerous task, which, if you live, may require your lifetime to complete. Is that clear?
Yes, General. Very clear.
Above all, you understand that your ultimate purpose is the extermination of the most rascally and dangerous criminal in the world, a traitor to the United States, a fiend who has caused the slaughter of thousands of your countrymen. I am speaking of the one known as Ivan Chark.
I understand.
You are ready to go?
My plane stands outside the door.
Good. Henceforth, until you have accomplished your final task, you will not be known by your true name. What name you will be known by rests in the hands of fate. How long do you think it will be before we know the outcome of this night's venture?
Sir, if I've not returned by 12 o'clock, you will know I've failed.
You are a brave man, Captain. Now, Godspeed.
Thank you, sir.
Into the night roars a plane piloted by a lone man upon whose shoulders rests the fate of his country. Hours later, he has not returned. The general of the Allied armies is waiting in his dugout with despairing hope.
What time is it, Major?
15 seconds to 12 o'clock.
Well, Major, I guess we're sunk.
It means disaster for us all.
It was too much to ask of a mere man. I should have known that...
Listen. Do you hear anything?
I do. It's a plane.
Listen to that.
We're saved.
Yes, and it's just 12 o'clock.
Yes, and to me, he shall always be Captain Midnight. Don't miss the exciting adventure tomorrow. Tune in, same time, same station, to Captain Midnight. Now... just a word about you. You who have just heard the opening episode in a new series of exciting adventures with Captain Midnight. If you like the way this program begins, keep on spreading the news to all the fellows and girls you know, will you? And don't forget to try Ovaltine this very night. It's not only a good-tasting drink, but it's good for you, too. You see, Ovaltine brings you loads of wonderful vitamins and minerals and other food elements our bodies need if we're to fill out and grow up strong and husky. Nobody wants to be skinny-looking and tired and worn out all the time. We all want to be regular fellows and girls, full of get-up-and-go, always ready for adventure. And that's why thousands and thousands of smart fellows and girls are drinking Ovaltine every single day. Why don't you try some tonight? And then be sure to tune in tomorrow, same time, same station, for another stirring adventure with Captain Midnight. Brought to you every day, Monday through Friday, by the makers of Ovaltine. See you tomorrow, and until then, this is Pierre-André, your Ovaltine announcer, saying goodbye and happy landing! This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Boy, was it nice to hear Pierre-André's voice again on that Captain Midnight show. Well, I have to tell you about Captain Midnight. Now, that was, I knew something about the date. I didn't just pick a September 30th of 1940 at random. That happens to be the very first day of Captain Midnight on the Mutual Broadcasting System, on the network. And, of course, the show originated in Chicago. In fact, Captain Midnight had been a very favorite program of youngsters after school on WGN, for a number of years before this. There was actually kind of a WGN regional network. And from Chicago, from the studios of WGN, actually at that time they were in the Tribune Tower, Pierre-André would announce Captain Midnight. Ed Prentice was Captain Midnight. Pierre-André there for Ovaltine. And Ovaltine was a brand new sponsor. That's the first time Ovaltine sponsored Captain Midnight. Prior to that, Captain Midnight had been on the air, sponsored by the Skelly Oil Company. Now you say, wait a minute, the Skelly Oil Company, a gasoline company sponsoring a kid's show? How did that work, you know? How did that work sponsor-wise? Well, the kids would listen to Captain Midnight. And the announcer for Skelly Oil, I think it was Don Gordon at the time, he would say, kids, ask your mom or dad... to bring you into the nearby Skelly Station and get your Captain Midnight wings. Well, can a father resist a son when he's saying get the wing? And the father is mostly not going to drive. He's not going to drive that old Model T, you know, or whatever, into the neighborhood Skelly Oil Station without really getting a fill up. So he'd say, fill her up or $2, whichever comes first. You know, well, those days are gone. But that was the first network adventure of Captain Midnight. Now, it was around maybe 4 or 5 years earlier that the WGN in Chicago became affiliated with the Mutual Broadcasting System. And you really want to know who was responsible for having WGN become a part and actually become one of the founding members of the Mutual Broadcasting System? None other than the Lone Ranger. The Lone Ranger, radio favorite, began at radio station WXYZ in Detroit, a very popular program. Now, the people at WXYZ, which was an independent station in Detroit, wanted to have more people hear the Lone Ranger, and they wanted more sponsorship involvement and all of that sort of thing. There was no room, and they didn't want to give up the Lone Ranger to NBC or CBS, either the Red Network or the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company. So they said, let us see if we can form a network of our own. Maybe we can just stretch out and start a new network. Well, WXYZ in Detroit got a hold of WGN in Chicago. They added WLW in Cincinnati and then WOR in Newark, New Jersey. And that became the Mutual Broadcasting System. It was really the way the Lone Ranger got started. Now, I'm going to see, using all of these knobs here in this great old studio, this master control room here, and this is really, it's really fantastic. I was listening to Captain Midnight here, and I found all kinds of stuff, and I wish you could come in with, well, I'll tell you about some of these things as we get into it. There's a drawer over here, you won't believe, clippings from the old days, and some old newspapers in here. And I'm going to look at some of the program logs in the old newspapers and see if we can't dial into some shows that were on. But that's a little later. Now, let's try to go back. Let's see. The Lone Ranger was on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday nights. I remember listening 6:30 in Chicago. My brother and I would finish dinner really fast so we could get in the living room, lay on that carpet in front of the radio. And we'd have the dial, the flickering green eye, all set on our big old Zenith console radio. And we'd listen to the Lone Ranger, and by 7 o'clock when the program was over, there was like a layer of dust an inch thick on the carpet. The Wild West was running again. I'm just going to set this day and date one here to, there's a notch here for Monday, Wednesday, Friday. They must have had the Lone Ranger in mind. I'll also set it up for Network, Mutual Net, and I'll just say any year. How about whatever year, 1941. Now, let's see if this won't work, and let us tune in to a little bit of the Lone Ranger.
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver! The Lone Ranger. With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early Western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse, Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Come on, Silver. Let go, big fella. Hail, Silver. Hooray!
Oh, man, the Lone Ranger. Those were really the days. I tell you, I remember something as a kid. Listening to the Lone Ranger, that was very, very traumatic for me. I had heard on a news broadcast on the radio, and then it was in the newspapers as well, that the Lone Ranger was dead. Now, I couldn't believe the Lone Ranger. How could the Lone Ranger be dead? And what's even more incredible, the newspapers and the radio announcements said that the Lone Ranger was killed in an automobile accident. Now, what in the blazes was the Lone Ranger doing in an automobile? Well, I asked my father, and he said, no, the actor who played the Lone Ranger was killed in an automobile accident, and that's the truth. Earl Grazier had played the Lone Ranger for many years, and he was in an automobile accident, and he died as a result of it. Well, this was very, very traumatic for the people at WXYZ in Detroit, and they had to get the program on the network and the mutual system and all of that other things like that. And they had to do something. The program was much too popular, far too popular for them to just cancel because the actor was no longer able to play the part because he had died in an auto accident. But they had a certain respect. You know, in those days, there was a certain respect for the radio listening audience, and they wouldn't put a new actor in the role of the next show. So the script writers out in Detroit hurriedly rewrote a number of scripts, and they had the Lone Ranger become very seriously ill, so ill that he couldn't speak. And so for a couple of weeks, all we heard was the Lone Ranger's heavy breathing as his faithful Indian companion, Tonto, nursed him back to health. At the end of 2 weeks, the Lone Ranger rode again, and it was Brace Beamer in the role of the masked man. And, of course, they rode on to fight all the crooks all over the West, the Butch Cavendish gang and all the other bad guys. And it was one of the great stories of radio, and it's a true story. Now, a question for you. You know, the Lone Ranger had a horse named Silver. He used silver bullets. His hideout was a secret abandoned silver mine where the silver bullets were forged. But do you know why all of that stuff, why silver played such an important part in all of that? It's because the original sponsor of the Lone Ranger was Silver Cup Bread. That's absolutely true. I'm really glad he wasn't sponsored by Butternut, because to have him ride off into the gathering twilight saying, "Hi-ho, Butternut," just wouldn't make it. I'm Chuck Shaden. This is the 60th anniversary broadcast for WGN Radio Chicago. We are here in an abandoned master control room at WGN Studios with all kinds of equipment around here. And, you know, I was thinking about the remote control button, the mutual network, and I thought about the remote broadcasts that we used to be able to listen to. You know, almost every night of the week, you could tune in to a dance band from some popular place all across the country, from the Hollywood Palladium or from the Cafe Rouge of the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York City. And WGN, along with the Mutual Broadcasting System, played a very important role in feeding those remote broadcasts to all the stations up and down the network. In Chicago, we'd get broadcasts, live broadcasts, after 10 o'clock at night, usually from the Aragon and the Trianon and the Edgewater Beach Hotel or the Palmer House or the Blackhawk. WGN's parade of dance bands led the nation during the 1930s and the 40s. We were able to tune into this spot on the radio dial to hear such bands as the famous Coon Sanders Nighthawks, or Jan Garber and the orchestra, Clyde McCoy and the Sugar Blues, Bob Crosby, Hal Kemp, Wayne King, the Waltz King, Lawrence Welk, and, of course, the old professor himself, Kay Kaiser. Now, along about 1940, a young staff announcer joined WGN, coming up here from Peoria, Illinois. His name was Jack Brickhouse, and this was before he started doing a lot of the sports broadcasts for WGN, and he did a lot of the remote broadcasts. That's what I want to tune in now. I'm going to check we've got the time reverse dial all set here on this, wait a minute. Boy, really, really dusty here. That's a cloud of dust, and that's not from the Lone Ranger. I think, boy, Gates, it says Gates on here. That's the company that manufactured the board. Oh my gosh. This is antique in itself. I'll have to take this with me to the next meeting of the antique radio club. I think they'd be interested in this. Anyway, we're going to tune in this old Gates board now. We went back to 1940 there for the the Captain Midnight show before. What if we go to 1940? Let's set this for October the 21st of 1940, for lack of a better date. And Let's go to the Black Hawk restaurant in Chicago. This is on WGN now, and this is from being fed to the Mutual Broadcasting System. I wonder what band is at the Black Hawk, and if we have any kind of luck at all, guess who the announcer is going to be. I'll turn this dial and set it. Stuck a little. Okay, let's go remote to the Black Hawk.
Black Hawk Restaurant at Wabash and Randolph Street in downtown Chicago comes Raymond Scott, extraordinary composer of modern music, his quintet and orchestra, playing for us now a half hour of dance rhythm. Raymond Scott is featured here at the Black Hawk nightly with an entirely new floor show, headlining the Black Hawk's Dancing Coeds. WGN and the Mutual Network from coast to coast, Raymond Scott plays his first number, a little jive melody inspired by a visit to Wellesley School. It's called the Wellesley High Jump. Orchestra, a change of tempo, a change of mood, and Clyde Burke sings, "Now I Lay Me Down to Dream." Jacqueline Connett, her arrangement of Maybe. Played for you by Raymond Scott, extraordinary composer of modern music, his quintet and orchestra coming to you from the Black Hawk at Wabash and Randolph in downtown Chicago. You'll enjoy the smart new photo murals, which are a part of the complete redecoration scheme here at the Black Hawk. Remember, for good food and good entertainment, try the Black Hawk. This program has been brought to you through the facilities of WGN Chicago. Your announcer, Jack Brickhouse. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
those were the days, huh? That was Jack Brickhouse broadcasting from the Black Hawk Restaurant at Wabash and Randolph in downtown Chicago on October 21st of 1940, and that's through the courtesy of this beautiful old master control board here in WGN's supposedly abandoned control room here. Really nice to hear that. And you know what else is nice? That both Jack Brickhouse and the Black Hawk are still going strong. That's really great. This is Chuck Shaden. You're listening to WGN Radio in Chicago. This is the 60th anniversary celebration for WGN, and we have found ourselves in this abandoned master control studio at WGN, and we're having some fun tuning in to some of the old WGN broadcasts that we can find right here with this whole bunch of equipment and in this room. I found an old radio log here from WGN, and this is dated Sunday, November the 19th, 1944. Now it's ripped a little bit. It's yellow at the edges, but it's for Sunday afternoon, and it has the lineup from 2 o'clock until 6 o'clock, and it says 2 o'clock WGN. Had a program called Quiz of Two Cities. Now, there's nothing else on here. I don't know what that means. Quiz of Two Cities. That might have been New York and Chicago, or Boston and Chicago, or it might have been Skokie and Morton Grove. We never know. Now, at 2:30, they had a program on called Hollywood Open House. Now, I would bet, and it says NET on here, on the log, NET, N-E-T. So that must be a mutual broadcasting system feed to Chicago. At 3 o'clock, another mutual program, Your America. Don't remember that. At 3:30, name of the song. Name of the song. Maybe it's what's the name of that song. That might be what it is. At 4 o'clock, you can't take it with you. Now, I don't think that would be wouldn't be a half-hour radio version of that famous play. Here's the one I was waiting for. I knew on Sunday we'd have this at 4:30, The Shadow. The Shadow. I'm going to see if we can tune into The Shadow. At 5 o'clock here, it says Quick as a Flash. That's a good show. At 5:30, Upton Close and the News. And at 5:45, this is local show, Dick Brown, Singer. So Dick Brown just came into the studio and he sang for 15 minutes until 6 o'clock. Now, that's the only page that's left here. But I want to tune this old Gates console board here into, now let's set it up, year 1944. Okay, 1944, day and date, Sunday, November 19th, and the time knob won't, dust, time knob, okay, 4:30. Now, let's tune into The Shadow.
Of men. The Shadow knows.
Once again, your neighborhood blue coal dealer brings you the thrilling adventures of the Shadow, the hard and relentless fight of one man against the forces of evil. These dramatizations are designed to demonstrate forcefully to old and young alike that crime does not pay. The characters' names, places, and plot are fictitious. Any similarity to persons living or dead is purely coincidental. Again next week, The Shadow will demonstrate that
the weed of crime bears bitter fruit. Crime does not pay. The Shadow knows.
Boy, this console played a trick on us here. It got the opening and the closing of the show and left out the story. Well, I mean, if you go back to the 1940s, you've got to leave out a few things too, I suppose. That was The Shadow. And, Andre Baruch was Andre was the announcer. He was also the announcer on the Hit Parade on NBC for many years. But he announced The Shadow. And when they talk about blue coal, Boy, that'll bring back a lot of memories. Blue coal, America's finest anthracite. I remember that very well. Man coming in the morning, a truck dumping a gigantic pile of coal in front of the house, leaving a shovel and a wheelbarrow and a man. And the man would spend the whole day filling the wheelbarrow with coal and wheeling it down the gangway and dumping it into a window on the side of our house into the coal bin. At the end of the day, he'd take the wheelbarrow and he'd turn it upside down on the grass in front of the house, and he'd take the shovel and he'd walk to the streetcar and he'd go home. And the next morning, the full coal truck would pick up the wheelbarrow and the man would be on it, and they'd go to some other place, and we'd have enough warmth all winter long. The Shadow was played in the very early years by Orson Welles. He played Lamont Cranston, the wealthy young man about town who learned the secret power in the Orient of how to hypnotize men and to cloud their minds so that they could not see him, and he could do great things on behalf of the forces against evil, on behalf of law and order. Now, opposite Orson Welles, and he was playing the Shadow even while he was scaring the daylights out of half the nation with that War of the Worlds broadcast. Now, the only reason he only scared half the country at that time, because the other half was listening to Charlie McCarthy on another network. But opposite Orson Welles as the Shadow was Margot Lane, right? She was the constant friend and companion of not Orson Welles, but of Lamont Cranston. And she was never known simply as Margot Lane. She was always the lovely Margot Lane, radio descriptive, the lovely Margot Lane. Playing the lovely Margot Lane was Agnes Moorehead. Yes, the actress who did so much on radio, especially that one suspense drama, Sorry Wrong Number, and if she was she was on Bewitched on television. You remember her from that. So we had Orson Welles and Agnes Moorehead as Lamont Cranston and the lovely Margot Lane. As I recall, the Mutual Broadcasting System didn't have an awful lot of stand-up comedy shows. The big comedians, Bob Hope, Jack Benny, Fred Allen, all those people, they were on the major networks. And not to say that Mutual wasn't a major network, but they just didn't have the resources of the big ones. And so what they did was they tried to come up with a little more low-budget programming, and that was very good for the listening audience because you were able to tune in to a lot of mystery and detective shows. And we heard so much of that on WGN in Chicago over the years, by way of the Mutual Broadcasting System. Now, since we're in this old abandoned control room here at WGN, and since this is the 60th anniversary of this radio station, I've been rummaging around here a little bit, and I told you I found some old newspapers here, and there were old program logs in this. Now, I've got the paper right here, and this is a program log. This paper is from 1947. So I'm going to set the dial here. I'm going to see how much this old board can take. I'm going to try to listen to four or five old detective shows. And I'm going back to 1947 here for, what's this? All right, Bulldog Drummond. Listen to Bulldog Drummond. Then here's another paper. This one from 1945. How about Boston Blackie? Okay. Wait, is this so? Oh, all right. Go back. It's ripped on the corner. This is 1940-something. I don't know what year this is, but this is going to be Nick Carter, Master Detective. I remember that. They'd bang on the door. They'd say, "Who is it? Who is it?" It's another case for Nick Carter. That's good. And then here in 1945, Thursday in 1945, we have Rogue's Gallery. Now, that was a program that starred Dick Powell. You know, he was changing his image from the young tenor, the singer in all those Busby Berkeley movies. Now he's on radio as a detective, a private eye. Richard Rogue, remember that show? Oh, what else? I know the last one I want to get. Sherlock Holmes. Okay, we'll go to 1945 Sherlock Holmes. If we can do this now, I don't know if we can outdo ourselves with this board now. This is going to be the real test. I'll turn several dials here on our time reverse machine. All these years, Bulldog Drummond, Boston Blackie, Nick Carter, Master Detective, Rogue's Gallery, and Sherlock Holmes. This should be elementary.
Thank you. the night, and into his American adventures comes Bulldog Drummond. The Mutual Broadcasting System brings you another exciting detective adventure with Bulldog Drummond, starring Ned Weaver. Champion of justice, amateur detective, celebrated soldier of fortune of screen and radio, Bulldog Drummond comes to you every week at this same time with more of his baffling and intriguing mysteries. For adventure and excitement, keep this rendezvous with Bulldog Drummond every week. And now, to tell us of his latest adventure, here is Bulldog Drummond.
When you're in my type of business, you must reconcile yourself to one thing: unpopularity. The people on the other side of the fence avoid you like the plague.
And now on to Dick Calmer as Boston Blackie, enemy to those who make him an enemy, friend to those who have no friend.
Well, Faraday, thanks for coming to the phone.
I just wanted to make sure you were leaving. Look, Blackie, why don't you take a couple of extra weeks?
Oh, I couldn't do that, Faraday.
Why not?
How would you get along without me?
I don't know yet, Blackie. That'll be much fun trying.
And just for that, I think I'll stay.
Inspector Faraday, I've been looking all over for you.
What is it, Holmes?
They found a dead guy on Pier 37, a guy named Chuck Sloan.
Murder?
I don't know. The report said accident.
Did you say Pier 37?
Oh, hello, Blackie. Yeah, Pier 37.
Faraday, that's where a guy named Fred Palmer has been setting up his rackets.
I know.
Anything that happens there is no accident.
Now, look, Blackie, don't excite yourself. Run along. Don't forget your vacation.
I'm not going.
You what?
I'm not going, Faraday.
But you...
I've been looking for a chance to get something on Palmer.
What about your reservation on the boat?
I'm canceling my boat trip so that I can sail into Fred Palmer.
What's the matter? What is it?
It's a case for Nick Carter, master detective.
Yes, it's another case for that most famous of all manhunters, the detective whose ability at solving crime is unequaled in the history of detective fiction, Nick Carter, master detective.
But, Phyllis, it's true. I know it's true.
But it's not true, June, darling. Don't you suppose I'd know it if you were going crazy?
But why do I hear these noises all the time? Why am I so cold when it's really warm in here? Why
Listen,
do I...
Listen, June, you're just working yourself up over nothing. Now, why don't you...
Holly just told me my mother acted the same way, Phyllis.
My husband didn't mean that.
Your mother heard noises like thunder in her ears. He told me that she was cold and shivering no matter what the temperature was. Alex told me that.
Well, even if that's true, it doesn't prove...
It does. I'll kill myself before I let them take me away. I won't go to an asylum. I won't. I won't.
A young girl convinced that she is going insane. A fiancé who is not convinced, who doubts that it can be true in spite of the evidence. An appeal to Nick Carter, master detective. The uncovering of a strange and unnatural plot. Not for money, not for power, but for hate. This is the story unfolded in The Case of the Demented Daughter.
W. Fitch Company, makers of those fine Fitch products, presents Dick Powell as Private Detective Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery. Rogue speaking. Well, I was suffering one of my regular attacks of rigor indolence last year when I decided to commune with nature in a gentle sort of a way. So I made a reservation at the L7 Dude Ranch out in the desert. The afternoon I arrived at the ranch, I was lolling around the swimming pool, exposing my epidermis to the sun and admiring the scenery, when part of the scenery walked up and took a poke at another part of the scenery over some of the most beautiful scenery I've ever seen in or out of a white satin bathing suit. The poker was a paunchy 45, the pokey a very slick 30. And the cause of it all was a lovely, lovely 25, blonde and definitely feminine.
Petri Wine brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to Dr. Watson tell us another exciting adventure he shared with his old friend, that master detective, Sherlock Holmes.
One night, it was on the 20th of March, 1888, to be exact, I was returning home from a visit to a patient when my steps led me through Baker Street. Since my marriage, I hadn't seen much of Sherlock Holmes and...
And you couldn't resist stopping by 221B, I'm sure, Doctor.
Of course I couldn't. As I stood outside the well-remembered door, I looked up at the lighted windows and saw the tall, spare figure of my old friend pass twice in dark silhouette against the blind. He was pacing the room swiftly, eagerly, with his head sunk on his chest and his hands clasped behind him. To me, who knew his every mood and habit, his attitude and manner told their own story. He was hot on the scent of some new problem. I rang the bell, and a few moments later, found myself standing before him.
Marriage suits you, Watson. You look in splendid shape.
Yes, and I'm feeling very well, eh?
And in practice again, I see. You didn't tell me that you'd gone back into harness.
Oh, how do you know?
Elementary, my dear chap. If a gentleman walks into my rooms smelling of iodoform with a black mark of nitrate of silver on his right forefinger and a bulge on the left side of his hat to show where he has secreted his stethoscope, I should be dull indeed if I didn't pronounce him to be an active member of the medical profession.
Same as ever, Holmes. By the way, I'm not interrupting you, am I?
Yes, you are, old fellow, but it's a most welcome interruption.
You're working on a new case?
It looks like it.
Boy, that's elementary, my dear Watson. This board works pretty good, doesn't it? I had all this stuff set up here, and we got all these detectives on there. That, of course, was Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce as Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Dick Powell as Richard Rogue on Rogue's Gallery. Lon Clark was Nick Carter, Master Detective. Dick Calmer was Boston Blackie. And that first one we heard in that little trail through the tunnel of time here was Ned Weaver as Bulldog Drummond. No wonder that a lot of people listened to WGN over the years for good mutual detectives. And they had some of their own detectives. There was a series on WGN broadcast locally right out of WGN in Chicago called The Crime Files of Flamand. And Flamand was none other than Myron Wallace, who later made his name Mike and went on to... Whatever became of him, I don't know. I've heard of him someplace, Mike Wallace. I don't know. He seems like he works only on Sundays, something like that. This is Chuck Shaden. You're tuned to WGN Radio Chicago. This is the 60th anniversary broadcast for this great radio station, and we're in the master control room. A lot of dust around here, a lot of old papers and some rusted equipment, but we seem to have got it working pretty well. And this is like, I feel like a kid in a candy shop where the owner is has gone away. I like that idea that we had all these detectives here, but you know, there was more on radio, on Mutual and WGN than just detectives. As a matter of fact, they had a lot of audience participation programs. They had programs like Mr. and Mrs. and Meet the Misses, and where some announcer would be out talking to a lady in a grocery store and asking questions, and if she did she answered the question right, he'd give her two cans of Milnot and say it whips, and that was the way it was. But there was a program that I remember my mother listening to all the time. It was called Queen for a Day. I'm going to try to get Queen for a Day on this now. And there was a quiz show called Double or Nothing, where you started off very low, and if you answered the question right, they doubled it. You start off with $2, then you double it to $4, and it would go on like that, or $1 to $2, however it worked. Then maybe you remember, as I do, a program called Juvenile Jury with Jack Barry. And he'd had these smart little kids smart aleck little kids. They were not like the quiz kids. Now, the quiz kids were real smart, and we hated them for it. But these juvenile jury kids, they were average kids, and they were a little precocious. And the audience and Jack Berry and all the parents, the grandmothers, I think, all they're cute kids. So we try for them. And then a good, if you remember a quiz show called 20 Questions, they had the questions based on animal, vegetable, or mineral, and then they'd tell you a subject, and you had to guess that, and they had a panel. Those are the programs I'm going to try to tune in now. So, and I got all this stuff from these old newspaper logs here, 1948 and 49 mostly, where this is from. Even at that, these newspapers are in pretty good shape. All several of them crumbled a little bit here, but that's... We kind of crumble, too, after all those years, right? So let's try. I'll turn the day and date knob this way and the year select over here and see if this old WGN control board can get in those audience participation and panel shows.
Every day, 5 days a week at this time, Alka-Seltzer and Philip Morris Cigarettes bring you Jack Bailey and Queen for a Day.
Would you like to be Queen for a Day? Yeah!
Queen for a Day, the Cinderella Show, transcribed from sunny California. Today we have more news about our mother-in-law queen for you listeners at home. On our stage, five excited candidates eagerly await their turn before the microphone, and here's the man they're waiting to meet, the king of the kitchen, your mutual friend and favorite author, Jack Bailey.
Thank you, Fort, for that fine salutation about my book, What's Cooking. Yeah, just write me. If you haven't got one, I'll tell you how to get one. Now, there's going to be a whole lot of excitement in store for our queen today. Alka-Seltzer and Philip Morris have plans to give her years of pleasure. Besides that, she'll have the thrilling memories of her 24 golden hours in Hollywood. Her own private Tanner Grayline limousine waits at the curb right this minute to whisk her away on her adventures. Luncheon is being prepared at the famous Nicodel restaurant in the center of Hollywood. Nick Slavik is the genial host to our queen. In the evening, the queen's limousine will drive her to Don the Beachcomber's exotic South Seas restaurant in Hollywood. She'll select whatever she wishes for her royal banquet from their extensive menu. To top off the evening, our queen will be escorted to Ciro's glamorous nightclub on the Sunset Strip. She'll be entertained by the latest H.D. Hoover presentation and dance to the very fine music of Phil Oman and his orchestra.
Campbell Soup presents Double or Nothing, starring Walter O'Keefe. Here now is Double or Nothing in Campbell Soup's Band of the Half Hour. Your paymaster of ceremonies, Walter O'Keefe. Okay, O'Keefe.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for such a hearty welcome. Greetings to all of you around the country, and inasmuch as school has not started yet, we do this broadcast in front of some of the most distinguished members of the Hopalong Cassidy social set. I am not kidding when I talk about Hopalong, because I swear I never would have gotten here on time today had it not been for my Hopalong bicycle. I've got a new Hopalong bike. Oh, it's wonderful. It's got chaps. It's got saddlebags. It is amazing to me the way they have Hopalong this. Hopalong, he's got it on soap. He's got it on gloves and hats and... This afternoon, Mrs. O'Keefe is going out to buy her first. She's so excited, she's getting one of the new Hopalong girdles. Which I think leads us up, and high time to Double or Nothing. We...
Gaines Dog Food presents Juvenile Jury. Yes, it's Juvenile Jury, brought to you by G-A-I-N-E-S, Gaines Complete Meal, a meal that nourishes every inch of your dog. We invite you to spend 30 minutes with the children of America as they attempt to solve the problems which you, the listeners, send in. Of course, if your problem concerns the feeding of your dog, our jurors will give you just one answer. They'll tell you to feed Gaines Complete Meal. Gaines is more economical to feed than any other type of dog food. Gaines is a meal dogs love. Gaines is America's largest selling dog food. And now to introduce the jurors, here's the originator of Juvenile Jury and our program moderator, Jack Barry.
Thank you very much, and hello again, everyone.
Waiting to prove that children should be heard as well as seen are five average alert youngsters. Their ages ranging from 5 to 11. Reading from left to right, meet
Dickie Olin, age 8. Elizabeth Watson, age 6. Charlie Hankinson, age 7.5. Peggy Bruder, age 11. Jonathan McBride, III, age 5.
Thank you, children. I'm glad you could remember your name, Johnny.
And here's that animal, vegetable, or mineral game brought to you by Ronson, the lighter with the famous one finger, one motion safety action. Press its lip, release its out, safely out the instant you lift your finger.
Yes, the world's greatest lighter for cigarettes, cigars, or pipes. Ronson presents 20 questions. And now, here's that man about questions, Bill Slater.
Welcome to 20 Questions, the absolutely unrehearsed program where you listeners send in subjects for our questioners to identify and not more than 20 questions. If we use your subject, you get a handsome Ronson lighter. And if our questioners don't get your subject in 20 questions, you also win a grand prize, a Hostess smoking set by Ronson, comprising a Queen Anne table lighter with matching cigarette urn and tray, all exquisitely fashioned in heavy silver plate. And listen.
I'm Ronson's mystery voice, hidden in a soundproof booth. I'll tell you what the subject is, and a poster will inform our studio audience. But we won't tell our questioners.
Who are Fred Vandeventer, famous newscaster, Florence Renard, musician and teacher, Bobby McGuire, our young high school student, Herb Palazzi, radio and motion picture producer, and our special guest tonight is that great all-time star of Broadway and Hollywood musical comedy, Mr. William Gaxton.
Oh, boy, I think, why don't we just sit here and listen all night long to these shows, try to sneak back and get the rest of them all. They're a lot of fun, and it was nice to hear Bill Slater on 20 Questions, Jack Barry on Juvenile Jury, Walter O'Keefe, vaudeville comedian, turned quiz master on Double or Nothing, and Jack Bailey asking every woman in America, it seemed, would you like to be queen for a day? Man, those were good audience participation shows. They were not monumental programs, but they were good shows, and they were very entertaining, and they were on, like Queen for a Day was on every day, Monday through Friday, and, when Mom had to go down in the basement and put the clothes through the wringer and that old wringer wash machine, and you have the old radio up on the top step of the stairs, playing some of these things, it made all that, drudgery, go a lot easier. And the next day when you were doing the ironing and the third day when you're doing the mending, shows like that coming to you from WGN Radio in Chicago, man, it was a real companion. It really was a companion to get through those times. That's where we are now, WGN Radio in Chicago. My name is Chuck Shaden. I have found my way into WGN's old abandoned master control studio where all this old equipment has been stored for I don't know how many years. I haven't found anything here marked WLIB from the old Liberty studio from Elgin, but there sure is a lot of stuff. And you know what I found while that was playing? I found a book of poetry, and it was really dusty. And I blew the dust off of it, and I opened it up, and written in the upper right-hand corner of the first page was the signature, Franklin McCormick. Now, he probably used this when he was on the all-night show on WGN, the Meisterbrow Showcase. Now, that was later in WGN's history, back in the 1960s. And I'm going to see if we can't go back and listen to a little bit of Meisterbrow's Showcase with Franklin McCormick. He was with WGN for so long. He was one of the long-time staff announcers at WGN. If you mentioned WGN, your next breath would mention Franklin McCormick, and then probably at the same time Pierre Andre, or going back a little bit further, Quinn Ryan. Franklin McCormick was a real fixture at WGN, and I'm going to set the dial here to March 19th, 1967, and see if this great old console here can't tune us into, it's gotta be kind of late at night, right? This has gotta be, when the city is getting quiet. We're gonna listen into the Meisterbrow Showcase.
Meisterbrow Showcase.
love you? I love you not only for what you are, but for what I am when I am with you. Hello there, I'm Frank McCormick, and that's my calling card. This is the All Night Meister Brow Showcase. And we're very pleased to be able to spend the next 6.5 hours with you from now until 5:30 tomorrow morning. And within that 6.5-hour period, we'll play the kind of music that we sincerely hope will make your night, a snowy night in Chicago, that much more enjoyable. If you're driving on the highways tonight, use care and caution. The roads are getting a little slippery out there. We've had a couple inches of snow so far, and the prediction is for more. So use a little care and caution. It's slippery in spots. You know, there isn't a day goes by but what some big convention comes to town, big or small. Chicago is about the busiest convention town in the entire country. It's so beautifully centrally located that people come here from all over, and sometimes there's 10, 12, 15 conventions going on all at once. The next time you come to Chicago on a convention, have a real good time. Enjoy the hospitality of a great city, the many things that it offers for your amusement and pleasure. Fine restaurants, fine hotels, beautiful stores to shop in. In the summertime, the lake shore, so many beautiful things to see. It's a great town. And I also hope that you'll get acquainted with Meisterbrau beer while you're here, if you live far away. Meisterbrau is available only in the Middle West. So if you're from far away listening to us and you've heard the show before, you get acquainted with Meisterbrau while you're here on convention. Meisterbrau draft beer is available in familiar, convenient, regular size bottles and cans. And each one of those cans or bottles is like a miniature keg of real draft beer, golden, brewery fresh, and so great to the taste. Meisterbrau. So when in Chicago, do as Chicagoans do. Enjoy the very best of beer, Meisterbrau.
Silent air is bitter.
need you, my darling. I need you. With its yearning, my very heart aches. The load that divides us weighs harder. I shrink from the jar that it makes. Old sorrows rise up to beset me. Old doubts make my spirit their own. Oh, come through the darkness and save me, for I am alone. WGN, a Claire channel serving the nation from Chicago. The time is 1:31 and 40 seconds.
Boy, that was really nice to hear Franklin McCormick again. This master control board here that we found in this old studio is absolutely priceless. This is something that... That really you can't beat. Franklin McCormick, a longtime member of the WGN family. You know, I never listened to, I never knew of Franklin McCormick as a reader of poetry, of course, until later, as we listened to the all-night Meisterbrau showcase, and that was on Tuesday through Sunday nights on WGN from 11 until 5:30 in the morning. And it was quite a show. I remember one of the things I liked, because I like the good old things. On Saturday night, they'd have a program at midnight, I think, called Curtain Call. And he'd raise the curtain. He'd play some old Eddie Cantor recordings and Al Jolson things. And he had George Jessel narrating a cavalcade of nostalgia from show business. And that was one of the great programs. Franklin McCormick and the Meisterbrau Showcase. You know, as a kid, however, I remember Franklin McCormick as being the announcer on Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. And that's what we're going to try to do now. My name is Chuck Shaden. This is WGN's 60th anniversary party here from Chicago. And I'm going to set this control board here. This makes H.G. Wells look like a piker here with all of this stuff that we have. This is fantastic. But I'm going to set this back. We were just at 1967 for Franklin McCormick on the Meisterbrau Showcase. I'm going to see if I can't set this back something like 25, 26, or 27 years. Let's go back to 1941, maybe, and see if we can't tune into Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy.
Jack Armstrong!
Jack Armstrong!
Jack Armstrong!
Jack Armstrong! Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy.
Wave the flag for Hudson High, boys. Show them how we stand. Ever shall our team be champions, known throughout the land.
Wheaties, breakfast of champions, bring you the thrilling adventures of Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Go on, it is too. Guess I ought to know.
Listen, I walked down there hundreds of times, and I'm telling you it's 3.5 miles even.
Hey, what's the trouble here, you fellas?
Oh, he says it's 3.5 miles to the Hill Street Firehouse across town, and I say it's 5 miles.
Well, now, you're not going to get any place by arguing. Why not let me help you? I've got the answer right here in my hand. Listen.
Hey, what's making that clicking noise? Open your hand, let's see.
Hey, it's some kind of metal instrument with a dial on it. I know, it's a pedometer.
Pedometer? Oh, yeah, I've seen those things in the stores. They measure the number of miles you walk. And golly, they're awful expensive.
Cheapers, isn't that a honey, though? What makes it work, anyhow?
Well, you can see for yourself. That dial on the front is graduated into miles and fractions of miles. You fasten the pedometer to your belt or pocket. See, here's the special clip. And you start walking. The mechanism inside begins to work, and the dial turns slowly like this. Now, just by looking at the dial, you can read your own mileage and tell how far you've walked. A quarter mile, a mile, two, three, four, and so on, up to 5 miles.
Boy, what I'd give to own one of those pedometers.
Yeah, think of the fun we'd have if we both had one.
Why, we could measure how far we walk on hikes and to school and back, and maybe we could be official mile recorders for the rest of the gang and keep track of how far we travel on camping trips. You know, I'm going to start saving my money for one now.
Listen, fella, have you got a dime in your pocket?
Yeah, I've got a dime, all right.
Do you have a package of Wheaties at home?
You bet I have. Well, I eat Wheaties every morning.
Well, then you can get yourself a Jack Armstrong pedometer like the one I have here, and all it's going to cost you is 10 cents in cash and one Wheaties box top. Not only that, but I'll promise you that this Jack Armstrong pedometer is just as accurate for measuring miles as some of the most expensive pedometers you could buy.
Well, what do you know? The swellest pedometer I've seen yet. And all it costs is a dime and a Wheaties box top. Where can I get one?
Well, just send your 10 cents and the Wheaties box top to Jack Armstrong, Minneapolis, Minnesota. You'll get your pedometer in a hurry.
Well, where's that we send to?
Jack Armstrong, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And don't forget to include your own name and address with your order. And another thing, you've got to act fast. These pedometers won't last long when all the fellas and girls hear about them.
Well, what are we waiting for? I'm going to send for my pedometer right away. That's the dandiest offer I've heard of in a blue moon.
You bet it is. And I'm advising everybody to get on the job and order now. They're going fast.
Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the bran.
This is Franklin McCormick saying goodbye until tomorrow for General Mills, makers of Wheaties, Breakfast of Champions, who have just presented another episode of Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy.
So just buy Wheaties, the best breakfast food in the land. Wave the flag for Hudson High, boys. Show them
all. Wave the flag for Hudson High, boys. That's Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, and that was Franklin McCormick there doing the announcing on this broadcast that originated at WGN in Chicago and was heard all over the country by way of the Mutual Broadcasting System. Or in some cases, it was heard on NBC or CBS. There was, in some cities, one station couldn't carry it, but the sponsor says, I want to get it in this town, so it went on another station. Just like some of the soap operas would be heard in the morning and on the West Coast on CBS, and in the afternoon on the East Coast it would be on NBC. And they did the same thing with the Mutual Broadcasting System. Franklin McCormick, a very versatile man, and I think I had one of those pedometers that I got from Jack Armstrong, eating the breakfast of champions, you know, Wheaties, and he could really sell it. He could sell it, and he got involved in those stories too. He was right there with us. Those were the days. We are listening in to some of the sounds that we've been privileged to listen in with because of this great set of equipment that we found in the WGN Master Control. Now, I know, as much as I hate to think about it, we're going to have to get back to reality sooner or later, because I think the Cubs are going to win a game tonight, and you're going to hear it on WGN. And we only have a little while left here, and I don't know if I can bunk in this studio overnight or not. I sure would like to stay here, and I wish you could be here, too, to hear all of these sounds. But we're going to whirl the dials one more time here to see if we can't find something very special. And I think one of the most special of all of the programs produced and created at WGN over the years was the Chicago Theater of the Air. In May of 1940, it was an ambitious music series that made its debut on WGN and the Mutual Broadcasting System. This series was presented live from the stage of the WGN Studio Theater, which had been constructed in 1935, just north of the Tribune Tower. And you have to think about that. They spent a lot of money, I think $600,000 or $800,000, constructing those studios in 1935, right in the middle of the Depression. So it was an ambitious undertaking. But Colonel McCormick and the Chicago Tribune had the resources, and they felt that they wanted to, they wanted a first-rate broadcasting operation. So they built a whole bunch of studios, and that was really a far cry from little four studio rooms over at the Drake Hotel. And they included a beautiful, beautiful audience studio. The stage was handsomely equipped with amber footlights and colored border lights. And amazingly and interestingly, the colors of the footlights and the border lights could be changed by someone in the control room to fit the mood of what was going on the stage. So if there was a mystery program going on, you might get a lot of blues and the darknesses, and then bright would come up when something would happen and all of that sort of thing. And they would change the scene like that for the studio audience. This was, of course, for the pleasure of the studio audience to enhance their experience as they came into this WGN studio. More than 100 actors, singers, and musicians participated in each Chicago Theater of the Air broadcast. Program was on Saturday nights from 9 until 10 o'clock in the evening. Colonel McCormick, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, the publisher of the Tribune, often was featured as an intermission feature of the program. He would broadcast from a special studio high up in the tower, which had all the equipment and everything else. And he would talk on different topics, often about the Revolutionary War. Many times, and this is kind of interesting, many times his remarks went on longer than planned. Many times his remarks went on longer than planned didn't leave this right amount of time for the rest of the show, and they had a second act of a production going on, so they had to revise and rewrite and edit and tear their hair out and everything else. But it was always a source of pride that the program would end on time, no matter how long the colonel went on with his stories. The program featured a musical cast and a dramatic cast. A musical cast would sing all of the songs, because this was light opera, operetta, and then they had a dramatic cast of fine, first-rate Chicago performers who would read the storyline. And it featured Marion Clare as the producer-hostess. The orchestra was under the direction of Henry Weber. This was a first-rate show. I don't know, they must have had 900 or 1,000 people could come to see it in studios at the Tribune Tower. Pretty soon the demand for tickets was so great that they went to the Medina Temple, and they could have thousands of people see this free show, and people would line up for hours ahead of time to see a fantastic broadcast. We're going to set the dials here in our special studio to November the 8th of 1947, because I found the program log here that said that was the night the Chicago Theater of the Air presented Rose Marie.
By Marion Clare, conducted by Henry Weber, written and directed by Jack LaFrandre, Mutual presents radio's greatest hour of music and drama, the famous Chicago Theater of the Air. Tonight's performance, Rose Marie by Rudolph Rimmel and Otto Harbach, starring Anja Cusack, Morton Bowe, and George Tautze. During intermission, later in the program, we are to hear a featured editorial by Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. Now here to set the stage for this evening's production and to introduce our stars is the distinguished producer of this broadcast series, our First Lady of the Chicago Theater of the Air, Miss Marion Clare.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. In looking over our schedule of operettas and grand operas to be performed this season, it occurred to me that only 5 out of the total of 35 works have their scenes laid in this country or on this continent. It has always seemed odd to me that operetta librettists are so prone to fly off to far parts of the globe for their story material. Rose Marie is arch proof that we can find plenty of glamour and allure right on our own continent. What more spectacular settings could be imagined than the glorious mountain scenery of the Canadian Northwest, which is the backdrop for the Rose Marie story? The story itself, however, is typical old-fashioned melodrama, almost a cops and robbers idiom, with villains running off with fair damsels and heroes coming to the rescue in the nick of time. But everyone knows that most operetta plots are make-believe anyway, so Rose Marie is no great exception. And to most of us, there's something fascinating and exciting about melodrama. Certainly, it provides the framework for some of the most popular of operetta music. The title role of Rose Marie is a most exacting one, requiring particularly great clarity and flexibility, as well as interpretive skill. For those specific reasons, we have chosen tonight Ancia Cusack, whom you will remember with pleasure if you heard our last season's Marriage of Figaro and Traviata. The hero's role of Jim Kenyon was originally sung by Dennis King and offered such an abundant opportunity to display flash and verve and stage technique that we naturally selected Morton Bow, colorful operatic tenor who has sung many performances with us, including this season's premiere of Fledermaus. In the supporting role of Sergeant Malone of the Northwest Mounted, we again welcome George Totsie of the Chicago Theater The Air Company, a versatile baritone who is fast becoming a national favorite. Ladies and gentlemen, the entrance of our stars. With Henry Weber on the conductor's podium, the Rudolph Freimel score takes us high up in the rugged Canadian Rockies of many years ago, high up in the snow country, where life was lived at a strenuous pace and only the fittest survived. The Chicago Theatre of the Air presents, for your pleasure, Rose Marie.
Rosemary, my darling, since I first met you, a beautiful song keeps singing inside of me. I hear it everywhere, across great mountains, and in the deep blue of the frozen sky.
Oh, it sings inside of me too, Jean.
The moon and the stars and the glistening snow all sing along with my heart.
Oh, when my Jean talks like this, my heart, she purrs like a little kitten by log fire.
What I do, I can't forget you. Sometimes I wish that I had never met you. And yet, if I should lose you, it would mean my very life to me.
man, that's wonderful, isn't it? That's Rosemarie on the old WGN Chicago Theater of the Air, one of the prestige productions of this radio station over the years. A little clip from our time machine taking us back to 1947. That's about it for now. The old clock up on the studio wall says our time is up. We'll have to leave this old master control room. You know, it's impossible to tune into 60 years of broadcasting in a brief 2 hours. We didn't even touch on WGN's distinguished news and sports coverage. We hardly mentioned WGN's commitment to community service, and we had time to mention just a few of the hundreds of WGN personalities who informed and entertained millions of listeners over the years. But each performer left a mark on this station, and the traditions they established over the past 60 years serves as examples to today's members of the WGN family, the people in front of and behind the microphones who begin another decade of quality broadcasting. With special thanks tonight to Judith Hoffman and Lorna Gladstone, we hope you enjoyed our special Diamond Anniversary program. If you did, why, we'd be delighted to hear from you. My name is Chuck Shaden. Happy anniversary, WGN, and thanks to you for listening.